Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the On Poly podcast. I'm Steve Pagan.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Today on the pod, some mayors are doing well at getting new homes built in their cities. Some, not so much. Whether the premier publicly praises your efforts or takes you to task depends on, well, you'll see.
We'll have a by-election update on what's happening in Milton, plus a federal by-election, which seems to have started a feud between the federal and provincial Conservatives.
Mm-hmm. And there are some new rules for conservation authorities, which critics fear will weaken watershed protections.
It's Friday, March 15th, 2024, so let's get to it.
Well, partner, we usually start these sessions by commenting on our respective wardrobes, and I think we should continue that tradition today because I can see that you are following up from what you had last week. Now, last week you had, what was it again?
It was back in my day, there were nine planets.
Right.
Remembering, of course, the late and demoted Pluto.
Which is no longer a planet, apparently.
Which is no longer a planet.
And this shirt that you're wearing today, do you want to take us through it?
Yeah, sure. So you've got, this is a representation of, you've got the sun, and then counting up or away from the sun, you've got, you know, Mercury, Venus, and then the Earth here, and you are here, and then the rest of the planets. But you were counting earlier and noted there's an absence.
There's no Pluto there.
Right. I guess I'm not maintaining consistency or something, but I like the shirt. And despite the fact that it is also missing Pluto, I decided to stick with the astronomical themes.
Makes me very confused, though, because last week you were saying that your world includes, or your universe includes, Pluto. And today you are clearly confirming, endorsing an eight-planet universe. John Michael, my head's about to explode.
I contain multitudes.
Okay. Well, here's what I decided to do today. Because if anybody, I don't know, I think a few people know that I like to hang out on Manitoulin Island from time to time in the summers. And the way you get to Manitoulin Island is you go from Toronto, is you go up the 400 highway, and the 400 turns into
Highway 69. Yes.
Take 69 through Parry Sound, Point of Barrel, up to Sudbury, then you hang a left on 17, come down 6, and there's Manitoulin Island. But the way that you first get there is up Highway 69, and it is a really, if you haven't done it, it's a gorgeous part of Ontario because they've blasted through lots of rock to create Highway 69, and it's just, well, it's beautiful. So I am representing one of my favorite highways in the province here tonight. Is that okay?
Yes, and well, you know, it was the King's Highway, and did they ever call it the Queen's Highway?
That's a good question.
Because it would
be
the King's Highway once again now.
It is now again.
Yes.
Yeah, there we go.
But I did the drive to Sudbury a few years ago, actually during the pandemic. I did a summer vacation up in Sudbury, and yes, a beautiful stretch of road.
I'm glad we agree. And on that note of consensus, on to issue one. Over the last several weeks, you've seen Premier Doug Ford call news conferences, often to give out expensive checks to mayors. For example, $112 million to Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow last month because the capital city met its housing targets. Well, the province wants to encourage more of that through its Building Faster Fund, or BFF. Ford and Chow are kind of BFFs now, aren't they?
They're getting along well lately.
They are. Anyway, guess who aren't BFFs anymore?
I'm going to say the premier and the still relatively new Ontario Liberal leader.
That is absolutely true. I know you won't believe this when I say it, but Ontario Liberal leader Bonnie Crombie was the mayor of Mississauga. Premier Ford and she have had numerous news conferences over the course of his premiership where they seem to get along pretty well. But then apparently something happened.
Yes, I would think it would be about the exact moment that Crombie became the leader of the Ontario Liberal Party.
JMM, you are two for two. Ever since then, the premier has insisted that the former mayor of Mississauga has the worst housing stats record in the entire province. But we learned something about that this past week, didn't we?
Yes, we did. We learned that, let's say, the premier's focus on housing starts as a performance metric is a little bit selective. We know this because the premier was in Windsor this week announcing some new highway funding, and he was asked about Windsor's performance on getting new homes built. Here is some of what he said.
Full disclosure, I love Mayor Dilkins. I know he's going to do a great job. I think he was at 36%, but I'm confident he's going to hit those targets. As I say, it's easy money. We call it the BFF fund. Building Faster Fund, I know he's going to do it. Matter of fact, we need it. With all this development coming, all these the economy booming, he'll get it done. I have confidence 100% in him.
Now, here's the thing. The premier is correct. Windsor only achieved 36% of the housing target that is set by the province. That was, in Windsor's case, 346 homes out of a target of 953.
Doesn't sound good.
Not great, right? Mississauga's numbers for last year, well, they got 39% of their target built, more than 3,400 new homes built. These targets that are set by the province, obviously, they scale for the larger size of Mississauga's population, in case that wasn't obvious. Now, I'm not sure either Windsor or Mississauga has a lot to brag about here in terms of these numbers, but the premier's own chosen metric here, there's nothing about Dilkins' record that is obviously better than Bonnie Crombie's.
Okay, so Ford praised Dilkins, said he was sure Windsor was going to hit the targets. Lots of indulgence and forgiveness there, unlike in Mississauga.
Yes, not to sort of belabor the point, but it does seem pretty obvious that if you are a friend of the premier's, or at least not an imminent political threat to the PC party, he's inclined to cut you slack if you don't make the targets. But if you are a political rival, a close political rival, you know, potentially somebody who will, you know, have a shot at defeating the premier in a few years' time, watch out.
Bit of a different story there. Well, this may be an opportunity to bring another element of this story into the mix, and that is, I just want to touch on some of the points made by Marianne Mead Ward, who is the mayor of the city of Burlington. And she thinks that the incentives around this BFF program, the Building Faster Fund, she thinks they're all wrong. For example, yes, municipalities have to approve building permits in order to get homes built, and they should do that as expeditiously as possible. But municipalities do not control interest rates, and high interest rates have slowed down a lot of housing construction. They do not control the supply of labor, which means if there's a labor shortage and a developer can't build, there's not much that a mayor of a municipality can do about that. They don't control supply chains, meaning if you're a developer and you can't get your hands on materials to build homes, well, sorry, there's not much the mayor can do about that either. So even if Mississauga and Windsor are down near the bottom of the pack, it may not be the fault of the two mayors of those respective cities.
Right. And we've definitely heard some sympathetic MPPs from the government side of the benches even echo those concerns when it comes to cases like Windsor. I would say all of the points that Marianne Mead Ward has made, some people watching at home would be yelling like, there are at least arguments one could make against those points. I think one of the arguments that a lot of municipalities have made is that developers are sitting on approved applications, mm-hmm. that they aren't moving
they are.
Forward. And, you know, I think there's some arguments about how much of that is actually true. I mean, one of the things that inflation rates also do is they make it very expensive to sit on land that you bought with a pile of debt, right? So anyway, I'm trying to silence the people who are yelling into their TV screens right now. But the premier was also asked about these points, about whether it's fair to judge mayors by building starts when there are so many steps between the city issuing its last approval and developers actually putting shovels in the ground. And he said, this was when he had the press conference with Toronto Mayor Olivia Chow, you know, he said, like, we don't want to talk about approvals. We want to talk about building starts, and that's what we're going to be judging cities on. That's the most important metric. And now he seems to be granting a little bit more slack to mayors like Drew Dilkins, at least.
Yeah, and I think the mayor of Burlington's point is, if you want us to be eligible to collect these funds because you want us to get shovels in the ground faster, then give us some metrics that we actually have under our purview that we can have some influence over. And as I just suggested from that previous list, though, there are a bunch of things here that are not under the purview of the mayor that she and others can't do anything about.
Yes.
So anyway, we'll keep an eye on this as we continue on to issue two. Well, we don't know yet if Ontario Liberal leader Bonnie Crombie will be running in the upcoming by-election in Milton, but we know who the PCs will be running. His name is Zee Hamid. And interestingly enough, he ran for the federal Liberal nomination in 2015. Wasn't successful. And he donated to Stephen Del Duca's election campaign. What party was Del Duca the leader of again?
I believe he was the leader of the Ontario Liberal Party.
I think you're right about that. So this is an interesting person to be running for the Conservatives in this election, but there we go.
You know, I have to ask how this will affect Bonnie Crombie's decision. Obviously, she's been getting a lot of questions. Will she run for the by-election in Milton? It would get her a seat in the legislature. It would up the seat count for the Liberal caucus in the legislature. But, you know, people may not know Zee Hameed's name, but he was a contender for the mayoral race in Milton in 2022, and he came shockingly close to doing what is almost unheard of in Ontario, that is defeating a longtime incumbent. Gordon Krantz, the current mayor who did win in 2022, is currently the longest-serving mayor in Ontario, and Hameed came within 1,000 votes of defeating him. It's really, really rare to do something like that in Ontario municipal politics. So somebody who's clearly got some name recognition in Milton, somebody that voters, including, I think we can say a little bit tongue-in-cheek, a lot of Liberals may be comfortable voting for Zee Hameed. And so I think that, you know, you could understand if Crombie were having second thoughts about whether she would run in Milton or not.
I don't know if I'm right about this, but I think actually Gord Krantz, who's 86 years old, he's been around a long time. I think he's actually been the mayor of Milton longer than Hazel McCallion was the mayor of Mississauga. I think he's got the record now.
Oh, wow.
Somebody out there watching should look that up and tell you. I think that's the case right now. Anyway, so yes, if he came within 1,000 votes of beating Gord Krantz, this guy's got some game. So we got to watch for him in this race.
Yeah.
Now, some folks around Bonnie Crombie were already of the opinion that she should not run in the seat in Milton because her time can be better spent outside Queen's Park right now as opposed to being tethered to the legislature itself. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think there's definitely some logic to that. I think, you know, a lot of this is also sort of an argument about, like, why did things not go so well for Stephen Del Duca, right? Like, how much of that do you chalk up to the fact that he didn't have a seat in the legislature? And there's, you could argue that both ways. I think probably the most important point that they're going to be talking about within Team Crombie right now is just, could she win, right? You absolutely don't want to put your brand new leader out and have her first political contest end up being a defeat. You know, is it worth running if you could lose? Probably not. But even if she wins, and this is sort of goes back to what we're talking about here, you know, one of the arguments against having a seat in the legislature is just that it's not that important to be in the legislature when there are so many other things that any party, but particularly right now the Liberal Party, needs in terms of fundraising, in terms of getting its message out, those kinds of things.
Can I go down memory lane with you for a second here?
Please.
This is way down memory lane. I want to go back to the 1960s because this scenario has happened before. And the scenario was this. Liberals need a new leader. It's early 1964. The Ontario Liberals need a new leader. There's going to be a leadership convention. And there is a lot of discussion about a guy, and for some of our more seasoned viewers, you will remember this name, Charles Templeton. Charles Templeton was a very highly acclaimed evangelist of the day, and he had a radio program with Pierre Burton. What the heck was it called? Dialogue? I forget. Anyway, they were on the radio all the time, and Charles Templeton suddenly had very high profile. And somebody said, you know what? You should run for the Ontario Liberal leadership. And as it happened, there was a by-election coming up in the riding of Riverdale in Toronto. And so Charles Templeton said, here's my plan. I'm going to plant my flag in Riverdale. I'll win the by-election, run for the leadership, become the leader, and take on John Robarts and the Progressive Conservatives in the next election. Well, guess what happened?
Didn't win?
He didn't win the by-election. Jim Renwick for the NDP won the by-election. So guess whose political campaign was dead in the water before it even began? And that was the end of him. So if people are wondering, why is Bonnie Crombie taking her time trying to figure all this out? That's why. If you're a new leader, you can't lose this by-election. Or it's just, never mind, it's embarrassing. You might just be the end of your whole career.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now, speaking of by-elections, let's stay in the province of Ontario, but cast our glance to the federal scene. Because last week, Jamil Giovanni, somebody we all know, has been a guest on the agenda many times. He won a federal by-election in the riding of Durham for the Conservatives. This is, of course, the old seat of Aaron O'Toole, the former leader of the Conservative Party. And you may know Giovanni's name because Premier Ford once appointed him to be Ontario's first community opportunities advocate. That was back in 2019. Giovanni later resigned from that position because he didn't like the government shutting down schools and introducing vaccine passports. At the time, he called the Minister of Education, Stephen Lecce, incompetent. And Giovanni was back at it this past week with some more pointed remarks. aimed at Stephen Lecce.
Pointed remarks is one way to put it.
Yeah.
In his victory speech, Giovanni railed against the liberal elites, but he included in his list of liberal elites the Ontario Ministry of Education and the Minister of Education. Of course, TVO is the educational broadcaster. We're part of this.
Under the auspices of the Ministry of Education.
The Ministry of Education. But last we checked, Stephen Lecce is a progressive conservative MPP, yes. Has served in the Ford government since their election win in 2018. And he also served time in Stephen Harper's prime minister's office.
Yes.
So the man is a dues-paying member of the conservative movement, seemingly, we thought, in good standing, but perhaps not right now.
Well, we spoke about the divide between the federal conservatives and the provincial progressive conservatives a few weeks ago. And I mean, here we are again. It's really out in plain sight now. We've got Pierre Poilievre, the federal conservative leader. I think I can use this word. He basically stole one of Doug Ford's caucus members, one of Doug Ford's cabinet members. This is progressive conservative MPP Parm Gill in Milton. Jamil Giovanni now taking shots across Doug Ford's bow, and Doug Ford firing back, saying Giovanni ought to show a little more gratitude considering Ford, in his words, plucked him out of obscurity, gave him a high-profile job in his office, and got him on the way to the political career he will now enjoy. What's going on here?
So there are so many differences going on between the provincial Tories and the federal Tories, and I think it's kind of fascinating. I mean, the first thing that I think about is just the difference between being in power and not, right? I mean, Doug Ford has been premier of a very large, diverse province for 5 years, and that just totally changes your perspective on things, right? I mean, think back to 2018, like right before and even right after the election win. I mean, the Tory party provincially was very aggressive, let's say, and that included things like, you know, reversing a bunch of liberal policies very, very quickly in those very first few months. It was all about like, we're going to reverse absolutely everything we can of the liberal agenda. You know, there's nothing that's safe, nothing sacred, right? And I think some of that energy is in the federal conservative party right now. There's just a really strong desire to just, you know, tear down the liberal government. So there's a bit of that attitude that has faded from the provincial party as they've been in power for 5 years. But I do think there is also I think we can sort of talk honestly about this, right? Like one of the reasons why federal conservatives are talking about education a lot right now is basically tapping into some stuff that we're seeing both in other provinces and south of the border, issues about, you know, whether parents will be consulted about, the gender identity of their kids in school, that kind of thing. And those are issues that Ford and Lecce, whatever your position on these issues, it's really interesting to me that they really haven't wanted to touch any of that stuff. I mean, again, we can go back to 2018. There was a brief window where they were talking about the sex ed curriculum, and that was a lightning rod issue for the party at the time, but they've backed really, really far away from that stuff. And really,
Danielle Smith
came to visit a few weeks ago, and the Ford Premier's office was putting out statements very clearly saying, like, we are not talking about any of that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's a social conservative agenda, I guess you could call it, that the Ford government is just staying well away from, as the Ford Mike Harris government did before them. They also came into office with a lot of talk about what socially conservative agenda they may pursue, and they never did. Anyway, there is a tendency to say, and I'm going back now to this Poilievre Ford, whatever we want to call it, brouhaha, there's a tendency to say, oh my goodness, we've never seen this kind of antipathy between a federal and provincial conservative leader before. But of course, that's not true. There is nothing new under the sun. And I will go back to the aforementioned Mike Harris when he was the Premier of Ontario. And Joe Clark was, you'll remember, this is after the Conservative Party basically exploded federally. Joe Clark came back into politics. He led a very small progressive conservative caucus federally. And there was a lot of antipathy between the two parties there. Some Mike Harris conservatives actually said Clark wasn't a true conservative, which is an odd thing to say about somebody who was the leader of the Progressive Conservative Party and had been elected the Prime Minister of Canada
yes.
under the banner of the Progressive Conservative Party. But there you go. And you can go back 45 years, again with Joe Clark as the federal Tory leader and Bill Davis as the progressive conservative Premier of Ontario. It's true, Mr. Davis did campaign a lot for Joe Clark in the 79 and 80 federal elections. But it's also fair to say I don't think Mr. Davis was particularly disappointed when Mr. Clark lost the 1980 election to the current prime minister's father, because there was a certain bit of sandpaper in the relationship between the two guys. So it doesn't happen often, but it happens.
I always remember relatively late in his life, the former Premier Davis speaking with then Premier Kathleen Wynne at an event at Ontario Place, and he just had this line that he used that always cracks me up about, you know, I always tell whatever premier is in office, you know, I'll do absolutely anything I can to help you for about until 3 months before the next election, and then
that's
I'm
right.
helping the Tories. And
right.
you know, for you know, it was a very charming but also very mercenary way of looking at the world.
And she understood. Bill yes. Davis, at the end of the day, is a PC Party loyalist. Was a PC Party loyalist. Anyways, on to issue three. There are many indications that this summer is going to be a lot like last summer. An unusually warm start to the year could lead to forest fires. So the climate is on our mind. Are we prepared for what's ahead? Okay, you want to pick up the story there?
Right. So anybody who, you know, was outside last summer for any extended period will remember that, like, the fire season was one of the worst on record. More than 4,400 square kilometers burned in Ontario. Recognizing that, the government has made a substantial investment in improving wildland firefighting, something like $20.5 million in funding. So hopefully that will help. You know, so it's always difficult to actually control these wildfires in the far north in particular, but hopefully that will help.
I'm going to do another Manitoulin Island reference here, because I do remember being up at camp, as we call it, on Manitoulin Island, not cottage, but up at camp, and we could not go outdoors. It was kind of shocking. There were nearby wildfires, I think in Kincardine, and the smoke had wafted over to Manitoulin Island, and you could not be outdoors, because if you were, guess what? You couldn't breathe. So it was a bit scary.
Well, I mean, there were days where, I mean, you know, we talk about, like, you know, should people still be masking indoors or whatever? I was masking outdoors in parts of the summer because I'm biking to work, and it was like you could feel it in your throat.
Well, let me bring up another angle here, because there's also the possibility that black bears will come out of hibernation earlier than normal in Ontario, and obviously that could pose some danger. We've seen them in downtowns of, you know, towns and cities and villages when this kind of thing happens in the past.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things where, I mean, I think when I first arrived at Queen's Park, you sort of chuckle about the idea of, like, black bear dangers, because it's not something that you're really used to thinking about. But in, like, large parts of the province, this is a big deal. The provincial government did put out a release warning Ontarians to be on the lookout for exactly this issue of, like, it's getting warmer and bears will wake up earlier, and a bear that's coming out of hibernation is waking up hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are the kinds of signs of a change in climate, to put it bluntly, that we necessarily don't always think a lot of. But, you know, like, these are costs that people have to adapt to if we don't slow climate change down. But I will get off of the soapbox there.
Mm-hmm. Let's do two acts here. We're going to start with the Conservation Authorities Act, where there are some new changes in the offing, and they will go into effect on the 1st of April, so less than a month away. Why don't you give us the 411 on how that is part of this story?
Right. So going back to the 2018 election again, right, when the Ford government was first elected, I mean, conservation authorities, and I'll get into a bit of what they are, but I'll just start off by saying they were certainly not universally popular among the new conservative government. And across large parts of rural Ontario, there was a big push to try and constrain what conservation authorities do. And so what are they? Well, these are agencies that now basically cover, I believe, almost all of southern Ontario. They are agencies established by Ontario law, the first one passed in 1946 as a reaction of the incredible sort of industrial expansion during the 1940s, World War II. You can't tell the history of the conservation authorities without talking about Hurricane Hazel in 1956. Hurricane Hazel dumps a ton of rain on particularly the west end of Toronto. And some people died, but many homes were destroyed. The conservation authorities, really become the premier bodies of flood protection in the province.
So how exactly do the authorities manage watersheds, as we've discussed?
Well, some of it is just providing information to municipalities. For example, you map where the biggest risks of floods are, and then you say to municipalities, like, you really can't allow intensive development in those places. They're also able to acquire land. That was a power that they were given, in particular after Hurricane Hazel. So, you know, large parts of the GTA, there are green spaces that are owned and operated by the Toronto Region Conservation Authority. They also do province-wide education initiatives, teaching kids about nature, that kind of things, and how to keep water supply safe. But they've always been at the sufferance of other levels of government. They don't have their own independent sort of sources of revenue. Their funding has been cut by multiple provincial governments, including, we've mentioned Mike Harris under Dalton McGuinty, and also under Doug Ford. When the Tories won in 2018, there really was this push to what the government said was going to make the conservation authorities focus on their core mandate. There was a sense among, particularly among some rural municipalities, that conservation authorities had really gotten beyond that core mandate of like flood protection and conserving green spaces.
Do you think there really was mission creep there?
I mean, there are certain stories that came out of things like Auditor General reports where I'm trying to remember now, this was a criticism from a New Democrat, as I recall, this was not like a doctrinaire conservative railing against big government, but there was a New Democrat from the Niagara region, I want to say, who had said, like, we've got a conservation authority that bought a boat and, like, nobody can tell us why they bought the boat. So I think there were definitely individual cases that you could point to where an individual conservation authority had maybe gotten off of the correct path, but whether that called for a wholesale systemic change is another argument. And what we're seeing now is the government has brought in changes. The changes are not as broad as some people were worried, but they are still substantial.
Well, follow up on that if you would, because the Minister of Natural Resources is getting some new powers. What does that look like?
Right. So the Minister of Natural Resources and Forestry, who is in this case is Graydon Smith, who we actually saw last week in that clip we played, minister will be given the power to issue development permits that the conservation authorities would normally be the ones to issue. Basically, he'll be able to instruct them to issue those permits and potentially like change conditions that the conservation authority might want to impose. So if a conservation authority says, no, you can't build that here, the minister could come in and say, actually, yes, you can. If the conservation authority says, well, you can build that, but only if you do X, Y, or Z, the minister will be able to say, you know what, don't worry so much about Z. And so some conservation authorities have raised some concerns about basically their work being undermined. One in particular had some spicy language about, dropped an F-bomb about the minister and then subsequently apologized.
Oh, who did that? Who dropped an F-bomb about the minister?
This was the head of, I want to say, the Conservation Authority in Essex, and I can't remember the proper title, he was quoted by the Narwhal, whose reporting we're relying on for this segment, used a profanity that we will not use on the public airwaves here.
Oh, dang, that's no fun. Sheldon, have you got that F-bomb clip? I want to hear that thing. No, okay, moving right along. Okay, so that's one act with some changes. There's another act that we're going to talk about now, the Endangered Species Act. What's different there?
So the Endangered Species Act was first passed into law in 1971, was updated under the Liberals in 2007, and does what these laws generally do. It forbids people from, killing or harassing or disturbing either endangered animals or, and this is the important bit here, the habitats of endangered animals. If there's a species of bird that is listed as an endangered species, not only can you not harm the animal, you also can't harm the area in which that animal lives.
Any changes to the status quo in that?
Yeah, so the government is proposing changes that would make it easier to build early exploration mining trails. Obviously, this government has talked a great deal about how important it sees as the mineral sector. You know, they talk a great deal about, for example, critical minerals in the EV supply chain, right? Electric cars need they need less oil, but they need much more, you know, nickel and lithium and these kinds of minerals. And the good news for Ontario, at least from the government's perspective, is that they believe that we are well positioned to provide some of those minerals to the global sort of EV supply chain. But in order to get at them, the government wants to make it easier to build these mining roads into the north, where much of these mineral deposits are.
Okay, with spring fishing season upon us, any changes in that?
Right, and so this is, we're getting pretty detailed here. I did not know about this species of fish until a few weeks ago, the red-side dace. It is a very small fish.
What color is it?
I'm going to guess it's red. but this goes back to that issue of habitat, and why I mentioned that is that some of these changes would make it easier to disrupt the habitat of the red-side dace in this case, it's relevant because some of the habitat of the red-side dace happens to be along the path of the highway, at the 413 highway.
Oh, it all comes back to the 413. So if I were John Stewart, I would say, go on.
So, you know, this is the kind of example of how, you know, how you can tell that a government is really focused on something in a let's say, single-minded way, right? The government wants to build the 413. They ran on it in the last election, and they are moving legislative obstacles out of their way, you could say, right? Some of the protections here that, you know, the law or the regulations had previously said that if there had been red-side dace in the last 20 years, mm-hmm. that was protected habitat. They've now shortened that to there has to have been red-side dace in that area for 10 years. So it's a shorter window, which will presumably shrink the areas that are protected by Ontario law. And, you know, there's a whole dispute going on between the federal and provincial governments about whether federal environmental legislation applies. That will be something that will develop and we will obviously keep an eye on. But Ontario does actually have to follow Ontario's environmental laws. And so mm-hmm. they are just narrowing the scope of environmental legislation to make it easier to build the 413.
I learned a new thing today. Red-side dace.
These are very small fish, but they do eat insects, and so they are like a non-trivial part of the food web. I guess a fish specialist would very much want to see them protected.
Amen to that. All right, let's go on to our mailbag. If you've got a burning question or insightful comment, we always love hearing what you've got to say at onpolitics@tvo.org. JMM, if you would, reach into that digital mailbag, if you would, and pluck out a letter.
So here is a question from listener Gabriel, who writes, Dear Steve and John, hearing from JMN that he is more of a transit and cyclist user and TVO's HQ is by the Eglinton and Yonge lines, do you both believe there might again be a pause in transit building? The cost here throughout Canada as well is tremendously expensive, and the Ontario line seems to be as expensive, if not more, than New York City's Second Avenue line. This is a extremely expensive subway project mm-hmm. in New York City that I think was originally proposed nearly a century ago. From Gabriel Joseph R., who lives in Regina, Saskatchewan, but is a frequent visitor to Toronto.
You know, it's interesting. Doug Ford is often portrayed as a guy who is very big on highways, pro-car, opposes the so-called war on the car. You know, when he was at Toronto City Council, he was very much of the view that there was this war on the car that he was very much opposed to. And yet, he will, by the time he's done, spend more on public transit. And not only that, the most expensive options for public transit in Ontario history. So, I don't know. Do you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, it's an interesting case because in some sense, Doug Ford is just inheriting a trend that started before he became premier where, you know, I would say starting under Dalton McGuinty, but particularly accelerating under Kathleen Wynne, the provincial government really started spending much more on transit than it was spending on highways. And even with the premier's fondness for the 413 and the Bradford Bypass and other highway projects around the province, it is still very much going to be the case that the province of Ontario is spending more on transit funding than it is spending on highways. I looked at these numbers a while back, I think one or two budgets ago, and like the margin is still growing, right? So we really are seeing a change in the idea of like what the government spends money on. So I find that fascinating. And as I say, it's not entirely Doug Ford's doing, but he hasn't reversed it either. Mm-hmm. To the question of like, will we see a pause in transit funding? I mean, one reason why we stopped building transit as expansively as we were in, let's say, the 1960s and 70s is, to be blunt, the 1980s and 90s happened. And we had a real series of fiscal crises at both the provincial and federal levels. Governments, you know, pared their spending way back. And transit was just one of the casualties of that and far from the only one. And so then you sort of ask, like, could we see another fiscal crisis of the same scale that would force governments to pare back their spending on things like transit projects? I mean, it's imaginable. Like, are we prepared for I'm not the first person to use this phrase, but like the gray tsunami coming of baby boomers aging into the parts of their lives where they are going to have the highest healthcare demands? I think a lot of people are saying, we're not really prepared for that yet, and that will have big fiscal costs. So I think I'm a bit more optimistic about the current era of transit building, but like, could it be, to semi-intentionally use a pun, could it be derailed? Yeah, it could.
Well, I don't like to make predictions usually because I'm always wrong, but I will predict this. Back in the 1990s when Mike Harris became Premier of Ontario, and not only did he decide not to continue the construction of a subway going across Eglinton, he actually had the hole filled in. I don't think we're going to be doing that. I don't think we're going to be filling in holes that have already been dug for the purposes of laying track to have subways in the future.
I mean,
just
again,
say yes.
I just, it would be so painful to go back to that.
Yeah, I don't think that's on. All right, let's continue. Here's an email from listener Peter McHale, who writes, "Hi, Stephen JMM. Thank you for your new format, the On Poly podcast show on TVO. We are watching The Old Way by Antenna. Over the air on channel 19.1. It comes in loud and clear and in HD. Okay, terrific. Oh, okay, here we go. Back to the train station story of the last several weeks. Re the West Toronto station. I just want to clarify that it was a CPR station. CP did the sudden demolition of the station. I believe that there had been some efforts to preserve the station, but CP, Canadian Pacific, preempted that. I remember waking up one day to the news on the radio that the station was very suddenly gone. In 1983, the CTC, Canadian Transport Commission, ruled that the demolition of West Toronto Station had been illegal." That's from Peter McHale. Toronto. This is a story. Isn't this funny? I told this story out of the blue probably a month ago, 3 weeks ago, something like that. And each week somebody wants to send in kind of a new piece of the puzzle in describing what went down. This has got to be 40 years ago in the west end of Toronto when CP apparently unilaterally tore down this historic train station, and people are still not over it, including Peter McHale.
Yes, stick with us for all of your West Toronto train station destruction needs. We will cover this until the very end. I actually do have a train correction to make.
Oh, let's hear this.
So last week I mentioned this because we're talking about the issues of provincial and municipal rules applying to railways, which are federally regulated. And I mentioned this case in Halton Region in Milton I believe I said last week that it was decided at the Supreme Court of Canada. That was incorrect. I apologize to our listeners. It was actually, as I was saying, that the decision was coming out at the Ontario Court of Appeals, the highest provincial court, not the Supreme Court of Canada. And as I predicted, the Court of Appeals did say that Halton Region's planning policies do not apply to a federally regulated rail. In this case, it's called an intermodal yard, where you take the shipping containers off of the train and put them on the trucks. But basically, Halton Region lost its case at the Court of Appeals.
I'm now waiting to find out with bated breath what train-related email we are going to get next week.
Well, I do want to say, if people want more information about this Halton case, I did write about it at tvo.org, because it turns out while they lost that case, Halton Region won a case in federal court. And if people want the details on that, and how could you not, they can go to tvo.org and read more.
Before my mind completely explodes, let's do one more email, this time from a listener named Bernice, who writes, "Hi, I'm a big fan of Steve and now a bigger fan of this show. Love the format and JMM as well. Bernice Zimnicki from Toronto." JMM, she loves you too. Isn't that a beautiful thing?
That is wonderful. I very sincerely, I mean, we're still, I think, getting used to this change in the format. But one of the things that is very gratifying is like the switch to the video and to the TV format. We are reaching a totally different audience, as well as, of course, people who've been listening to us on the podcast for years. And it's just, it's neat when people reach out.
Give the email address, young fellow, would you?
It is... how am I forgetting the email that we say multiple times?
It's a thing.
Anyway, again, if you would like to ask about content on the show, please email us at onpolitics@tvo.org. And not every email has to be about trains, though we do love the train ones.
Yes, we do. Choo-choo. That is the On Poly podcast for this March 15th, 2024.
You can follow our show on Apple Podcasts so that you get notified each time a new episode is available. And if you already follow our show, help a friend follow it too.
Any feedback you have, we're happy to hear it, good, bad, or indifferent. Here's that email address again, onpolitics@tvo.org. And be sure to include your first and last name and where you're located.
This week's episode was produced and edited by Matthew O'Mara, video editing by Colin Kish.
Production support from Jonathan Hallowell, Christine Gardner, Arianna Longley, Vito Tagarelli, Jeff Cusera, and Jennifer DeRosa.
Our managing editor is Katie O'Connor. Lori Few is the executive producer of digital. John Ferry is vice president of programming and content.
And let's not forget about our wonderful studio crew here, who has allowed us, through their expertise, to have this podcast be visual every week as well, which we very much love. So, until next Friday, everybody, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.